My NBA draft guide is dropping on Friday, and on Sunday, we're going to have a busy week of podcasts because the draft lottery is on Sunday. I'm going to be doing an instant mock draft, winners and losers coming out on Sunday. On Monday and Tuesday, we'll be back as usual this month talking about the playoffs and everything else going on around the NBA. But today, we got Tom Haverstraw talking about the NBA playoffs. Some game twos just happened. A lot of stuff happening involving Giannis Antetokounmpo, Jaylen Brown, and we look ahead to the draft lottery as well with our draft lotto superlatives. That's all coming up right now with me and Tom. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. The NBA playoffs are rolling. The draft lottery is on Sunday. We're going to talk about it all. Tom Haverstraw, how you doing, Tom?
Doing great, Kev. I'm pumped and jacked to be here.
Hell yeah, Tom. We had one good game last night and then one blowout. We'll talk about both of those. We'll look ahead to Thursday night's game twos as well. Knicks beat the Sixers 108-102 to go up 2-0. In the series, Tom, we got news a few hours before the game that Joel Embiid was going to miss this one with more lower body issues. So no Embiid for the Sixers, no Mitchell Robinson for the Knicks. This was a tactical shift game for Philadelphia. We saw more switch heavy, and the big one was VJ Edgecombe defending Jalen Brunson. And in this game, that led to Edgecombe defending him 94 feet. We know Nick Nurse, what he did in the finals, boxing one against Stephen Curry. A little hints of this in this game with Edgecombe just sticking to Brunson. And yet, like, despite the fact, you know, at times it did slow Brunson up, put him into tougher positions, slowed up the Knicks' offense. Sixers go 1 of 10 from 3 in the fourth quarter. And Jalen Brunson still getting his, still making tough shots one-on-one to end the game in a quarter that the Sixers scored only 12 points. Knicks pulled ahead and win that one 108-102. So the adjustment helped, but wasn't quite enough.
Yeah, and this is, I think, the theme of what we're seeing over the last few years in the NBA is mobility over miles, meaning a lot of youth is coming in handy in the league, whether it comes from the Oklahoma City Thunder and how they pressure you full court, the Indiana Pacers and how they did that last year in their Cinderella run to the NBA Finals and almost winning the championship. And you're seeing it over on the San Antonio Spurs side where they're just hounding the Minnesota Timberwolves and doubling everywhere. And you're seeing it here in this series where Nick Nurse is deciding to go with a 20-year-old rookie to guard Jalen Brunson full court, which is a radical strategy. And it ended up, you know, giving the Sixers a chance. It gave them a prayer in a game in which they lost Joel Embiid pregame due to those assortment of injuries. And so for the fact that the 76ers were able to have this to be a close game, it is a testament to their strategy giving them an opportunity, which is really, Kev, all you can ask for. And ultimately, you know, the OG Anunoby story is going to loom large over this series. But I do feel like the 76ers have to feel better about their game two performance, certainly, than what they did after game one.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I mean, I think for the Sixers, hopefully they can get Joel Embiid back in game three. No certainty there, but he will have 3 days of rest. So we'll see what happens with Embiid in that game. But ultimately, I did think in this game too, like I said, Brunson, you know, 9 of 21 in the game. It wasn't his best performance by any means. He got it done in the end when it mattered most. But again, Karl-Anthony Towns is playing the best basketball of his entire life. He has been extraordinary ever since Mike Brown made the switch midway through the Hawks series. And then in the third quarter, he had 11 points, 3 assists in the third quarter. This was an important run for the New York Knicks because the Sixers were up at times throughout this quarter, and Cat was scoring in different ways, making plays for others as well. He just is playing at a high level. I mean, it's 20 points, 6 of 8 from the floor, got to the line, 10 rebounds, 7 assists. He's doing everything and playing great defense. We've seen Cat be a playoff riser before, Tom, in the series where the Wolves a few years back beat the Nuggets, but I don't think Cat's been ever better than he has been right now this past 10 days or so.
We can't talk about it enough, this Cat resurgence, when we're talking about a guy who averaged 1 assist a game in the postseason last year and now is leading the Knicks in assists in that column. Crazy. He has over 6 per game here, almost a triple-double. If the Knicks hit a couple of those shots, he's having his third triple-double of this postseason. Like, we can't talk about this enough. It is a totally new groove for Karl-Anthony Towns. It's unlocked Jalen Brunson late in these games, who has been clutch in the past, but you're asking him to run on empty after the long postseason runs to try to do it again? No. Mike Brown has implemented this flex motion offense with Karl-Anthony Towns at the top of the key. And I love these water polo passes from him. The Nikola Jokic just palming the ball and then whipping it across the floor. Mikal Bridges getting him a couple times on these back cuts. And it's beautiful basketball. It's my favorite thing in the NBA is big men playing like guards, where they're able to showcase their skills. Bill Walton, Nikola Jokic, Karl-Anthony Towns, these guys who are so multi-talented, ability to make plays for others. And whether it's OG on these cuts or Mikal Bridges, and in that series against in the opening series, when you saw Jalen Brunson going against the Atlanta Hawks, getting 8 baskets at the rim, oftentimes from those Towns passes, this is a completely new system for Mike Brown that he's operating Karl-Anthony Towns in that hub. And I think it's given that juice for Jalen Brunson, given that juice late in the game to have those 8 four-quarter points, which led all players in this one.
I just chuckled because of when you said Bill Walton, Nikola Jokic, Karl-Anthony Towns. I mean, one of them is unlike the other so far, but we'll see. The Knicks very well could be on their way to winning an NBA Finals with the way they've been playing as of late. They did flip a switch. Mike Brown unlocked Cat. This has been huge, for sure. Jalen Brunson has the right balance now of on-ball and off-ball. OG Anunoby, who we'll talk about a little bit later with his injury at the end of the game, has been excellent as well. Mikal Bridges quietly looks back. Mikal Bridges, game 6 against the Atlanta Hawks, had 24 points, 3 assists. He was 10 of 12 in that game. Game 1 against the Sixers, 17 points on 7 of 10, 5 assists. Game 2 against the Sixers, 18 points on 9 of 13, 2 assists. So he's doing this on the offensive end of the floor. He had a pretty clutch shot at the end of game 2 as well to kind of, it was a dagger for Philadelphia. He's scoring offensively, 0 turnovers over these 3 games, by the way. And he's been excellent defensively as well. And so Mikal Bridges, midway through the Hawks series, was one of those guys after a long up and down regular season stretch. It's like, well, can't rely on this guy. Last 3 games, you could. And on top of Cat, on top of the balance for Brunson, on top of OG, hopefully he can get back. Bridges looking like this makes this Knicks team look like the dream version of what people could have imagined when we looked at this team on paper and thought, oh, they have enough talent to be the finals favorites in the East. Well, here it is. This is what that roster looks like with Bridges playing like this.
Yeah, and this is what you want to see from Mikal Bridges. With the absence, potentially, of OG Anunoby going forward, you need that wing play. So there's a train going by here. There's a Mikal Bridges opening for him to, you know, become that step up and become that guy that they acquired and sent all those picks for. And it was not long ago, Kev, that Knicks fans were rioting about how Mikal Bridges was looking like one of the worst trades when you look at all the assets that they put in, and now they are losing all of those assets. The opportunity cost of making that trade for Mikal Bridges is that you're going to be hard pressed to go make a big swing for a guy like Giannis Antetokounmpo if he wants to come to New York. You don't have those long-term assets that a team like Milwaukee might want. And so instead you have a negative contract with Mikal Bridges and none of those picks going forward. Now he's looking like that star. And again, the production in the mid-range, the big shots that you're seeing him when he's getting those cuts to the rim with Karl-Anthony Towns, I don't think it's a coincidence, Kev, that Karl acting as a hub has unlocked this new resurgence for Mikal Bridges. And I think this is kind of what you wanted to see from Tom Thibodeau in years past, is like all this dribbling the air out of the ball from Jalen Brunson and trying to create all the time from that one engine, I think it limits the upside for the rest of the players. And so for Mikal Bridges playing off the ball, a lot of times working in those cuts, those basket cuts off of Karl-Anthony Towns, I think it's making him a better player.
I think that is 100% spot on, Tom. I mean, I think it all kind of stems from that decision to put the ball on Cat's hands more. It's caused a domino effect that helped held everybody else on that roster. And I mean, it's hard to say with Bridges, like at one point midseason, it's like, oh, this is just not the same guy defensively. But this series against Tyrese Maxey, particularly this game too, he locked him up. He made his life really hard. And granted, there's an element of fatigue from Maxey. Finishes a hard-fought seven-game series, playing heavy minutes, plays 47 minutes in this game. I mean, he was visibly gassed by halftime in the middle of that second quarter. He finishes with six turnovers in the game. He was short on jumpers. And I can't help but watch this game, Tom, and feel like, well, maybe the Sixers actually lost this series way back in February when they traded Jared McCain. It's like not like McCain's going to swing it entirely, but boy, it sure would be nice to have a guard to give Maxey a breather for 4 minutes. He's got the ball in his hands constantly. He's running around on defense. That's 47 hard-fought minutes. It's no wonder why he's so tired at the end of the game. They could have used more bodies. They're just, their rotation's just so light, Philly, compared to New York.
Yeah, Quentin Grimes could help here, but not his best performance in game two. But you're right, is that it would help to
he's
have
Jared. He's so up and down, Tom. Grimes is like, he's 25 points per game for 2 weeks, and then he's what he was last night, 7 points, 1 of 4 in game two for 2 weeks, stretches at a time. It's so weird.
Yeah, and I think also Maxey, low-key, is banged up. You know, I think he's also fatigued, but his hand injury, that it seems like it's creeping back up here, it doesn't look good for the chances of Philly if Tyrese Maxey and Embiid are hampered with injuries. Embiid obviously not being it, playing at all in this game, but even if he comes back, how much can you really rely on him? And with Maxey, with the hand injury, it just doesn't look like he's comfortable. He's certainly favoring it. And a lot of the Mikal Bridges pressure, the defensive pressure, is getting to him, and it's exhausting. Like, we keep talking about this, but it's the single most underappreciated element in playoff basketball is the energy expended when you are having to do the James Harden dribble, 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 and try to create out of nothing. And I think moving Jalen Brunson off the ball and then the injury to Joel Embiid and forcing Tyrese Maxey to create the offense for himself, I think it is going to be really challenging for Nick Nurse to find the right lineups, to find the right system in order to maximize Paul George and VJ Edgecombe to take some pressure off of Tyrese Maxey. Now, I think the process, no pun intended, was sound in this game. And going back to Philly, I feel like they still have a chance to even up this series. I don't think they have a good chance to win this series, but at least you saw they were able to at least put some defensive pressure in ways that OG Anunoby coming off this game with a potential injury, the door is open if the Sixers want to take game three.
Yeah, I think the OG Anunoby injury, Tom, happens with 3 minutes left in the game. He had completed a unbelievable performance. He showed why he's an all-defensive player, or should be, with his rim protection, the pressure on ball, the help defense, the communication. OG like just checks every box as a defensive player. And then he suffers the hamstring injury at the end of the game. And so if there's an opening here for the Sixers, it's the fact that, like you said, I agree with you. I think the game plan was good. I think the ball pressure on Brunson with Edgecombe was smart. I thought the good quality shots on offense, more switching on defense. You get Joel Embiid back, it helps you in those fourth quarters where they're 1 for 10 from three. They're not able to get quality shots. Embiid helps there, assuming he can come back for game three. There's an opening. If OG Anunoby's out, that could open things up for a Paul George to have a big night. I think there's an opportunity there. I think in the fourth quarter of that game as well, we saw the Sixers put Paul George more on Karl-Anthony Towns. And I think that did discombobulate the Knicks offense a bit. I'm sure they'll come with their own adjustments as well. Maybe we'll see Kat on the low post and just overpower George in game three. But fact is that Philly had a pretty good game plan without Joel Embiid. And I wouldn't rule them out winning a game three, winning a game four, and it's back in New York at 2-2, or it's 3-1, then they make it 3-2, and it's back in Philly for a game six, something along those lines. I'm not ruling Philly out, Tom, but until we really get word on Joel Embiid, 3 days rest now for him entering game three. If he's back, that gives them a shot. But without Joel Embiid, it's very similar to the Celtics series. They have a higher ceiling with Embiid, perhaps a lower floor if he's not healthy, but they need to tap into that higher ceiling to have any chance to beat the Knicks in this round, especially given the way New York's playing.
Yeah, and let's be honest, it was not a good sign that they ruled him out at 1 o'clock on game day after it was.
Was it load management, Tom? Is that what it was? Playoff load management? Like, because they can't survive with Embiid. He probably shouldn't even have played game one, if we're being honest, after the series against Boston. Maybe get him 3 days of rest. You don't think so?
I don't think it was load management. I think it was a legit injury, because if it was load management, Kev, I kind of feel like they would play a little bit of poker here and just say he's now questionable. Sure. And have him right up until game time, the Knicks thinking that he's going to play, and then rule him out last second. No,
when I say load management, I do think there's a real injury, but I think perhaps like it's something you could decide to have him play through, or you decide just to, hey, look, let's rest him for today to get extra rest to have any shot. You know what I mean?
I see what you're saying. I think for sure it's a look. The Embiid injury report history is one of the oldest tales in the NBA. There could be a whole book written about how they have handled Joel Embiid's injury status. And there was that ESPN feature, an amazing feature in the offseason about Joel Embiid and how insecure he is about the injury reports and the fact that his body is betraying him oftentimes and so frustrating. We've seen him now miss games in 5 out of the last 6 series for Joel Embiid. And so I can understand why this is so frustrating for him, so frustrating for Philly fans and for the medical staff, where up until 12:45 yesterday, Kev, on the injury report, Joel Embiid was listed as probable, not questionable. He was probable to play, and then at 1 o'clock, they ruled him out. It wasn't a situation where we'll see what happens, we'll try to get some treatment pregame. It was, went from probable to out. And the NBA has had fits over this with the injury reports. They have fined the 76ers for how they've handled Joel Embiid's injury reports. And this going from probable to out at 7 hours before tip time, it suggests to me that they either saw something in the imaging or saw something the way he was moving and just said, look, if we're going to have any chance in this series, we cannot let you play in Wednesday night's game 2. We need to get you ready for the latter part of the series. And unfortunately, man, this has been the story of the playoffs the last few years, is the injuries basically in every series of this postseason. We're now dealing with Joel Embiid and OG Anunoby out, and potentially Tyrese Maxey also being injured. I wish they were all, ready to go and 100%, but this Embiid factor looms just over this franchise continually. And man, the Sam Hinkie tweet where he does the clapping from Rudy Gobert, that is the moment of the postseason for the Sixers and all my Sixers friends. Yeah. Like, they have that moment. And even if Embiid doesn't play another moment in this series, I think for the Sixers fans, yes, they would love a postseason run. They would love finally a conference finals appearance with Joel Embiid and the Sixers. But it does feel like this is house money for the Sixers beating the Boston Celtics finally.
Later in the show, there will be a Sam Hinkie mention when we do our draft lottery superlatives ahead of the NBA draft lottery on Sunday. But right now, let's continue with the Eastern Conference playoffs. Pistons won game 1, 111-101. Game 2 is tonight. Tom, on the big number this week, you and Dan talked about the 29 games for James Harden with more turnovers than field goals. You really got me depressed hearing that as a Harden believer. 22 points on 6-15 with 7 turnovers in game 1. He said a lot of them are on me after the game. He's 100% right. Appreciate the honesty. It's not just Harden, though. I mean, Donovan Mitchell in that game, he disappeared for a long 12-minute stretch from 3:40 in the second quarter until 3:35 in the third quarter. I'm watching the game like, where's Mitchell? What happened? He took only 2 shots during that stretch. He had 2 turnovers. He sat only 3 minutes of that entire 12-minute stretch, by the way. He just did nothing. And then Mobley ended the game. You have Jared Allen in foul trouble, 4 fouls in 18 minutes. He's getting punked all game. Mobley ended the game. The Cavs just look small out there with Jalen Duren and the Pistons looking huge and overpowering Mobley. I thought Atkinson should have played Jared Allen. But my main takeaway from game one, Tom, is the Pistons were able to play bully ball. They were able to just do what they weren't able to do in round one against the Magic, plus 5 in offensive boards, plus 8 in turnovers, plus 15 in points off turnovers. And then the Cavs side of things, I mean, they didn't get blown out. They still were in this game. They still had a shot. Their star players just need to be straight up better. All of them. Harden, Mitchell, Allen, Mobley, all four of those guys have to be better to have any chance in this series, because the Pistons are going to keep bullying. That's not going to stop, I don't think.
Yeah, the Pistons can keep bullying because it's the Cleveland Charmineers. They are Charmin soft in the last couple postseason, man. Evan Mobley, Donovan Mitchell. Donovan Mitchell was talking about after the game, I'm not getting to the free throw line because I don't flop. No, it's because you're not playing with any sort of physicality and aggression. And I think when you see the free throw totals, it makes perfect sense. I don't think Donovan Mitchell is 100% healthy, but the way that he was playing, like you said, disappearing for large swaths of that game, I don't have any confidence in this Cavs team when you play a more physical team up front like the Jalen Duren, Cade Cunningham, and Isaiah Stewart front line for the Detroit Pistons. This is totally different than the Toronto Raptors, right? Brandon Ingram is not, and Jakob Poeltl is not, they're not going to strike the fear in you when you are going against them in that front court. But this is a different series against the Pistons, and Jalen Duren erupted down the stretch when it mattered most. Cade Cunningham finding him for those baskets late, and the Cavs continue to play soft, soft, soft. And this is so, like, I was happy with the James Harden acquisition, but then come playoff time, he has these what I call crash out games where he has more turnovers than field goals. And the reason why that's interesting is because so much of Harden's game is predicated on getting the whistle from the officials. And when the officials aren't giving him those foul calls and he's getting hit when he's driving and he's getting contact and they slap at the ball. And usually in the regular season, they might be foul calls, but in the postseason, they're swallowing their whistle and inevitably he's going to turn the ball over. And what you're seeing is you could add up LeBron, Steph, KD, Giannis, Luka, Jokic, all of those players, the most those games that they've had turnovers exceeding the number of field goal makes for those guys, LeBron, Steph, KD, Giannis, Luka, Jokic, you add them all up and they still do not outpace James Harden alone with 29 such games. And so you're right. It wasn't just James Harden, even though he had 7 turnovers and more 6 field goals.
That hurts.
But if you look at this list, LeBron has 118 more games than James Harden played in the postseason and 18 fewer of these games. And make no mistake about it, this guy also had so many runs where he's the only creator on the team. We talk about the Dellavedova NBA Finals trip. You would expect so many more of these for LeBron based on how much he's been doubled and triple teamed and going 1-on-5. And yet James Harden is outpacing him like 3-1.
That's a very hurtful stat, Tom. That stat hurts me to the core. It's pretty bad. Let's take it off the screen. Get rid of it. I can't look at it anymore. It hurts too bad. As a Harden guy, it makes me sad. But he was terrible in game one. He's 100% right after the game how it's, you know, a lot of them were his fault. He's just got to be better. This is not his first game this postseason like that. I think he just looks old to me. He looks slow. He can't generate space in the same way. Like, he looked way better during the regular season. Maybe he's hurt. Maybe he's dealing with something. I don't know. Maybe it's something mental. I don't know. Also, the defense is better. You're going to give credit to the Pistons there as well. They have a lot of dogs that can harass Harden. But he's going to be straight up better. Mitchell, like you said, maybe he's not healthy. For the Cavs, I mean, Jared Allen playing 18 minutes, that's a no-go. Even in those minutes, he's a +4. They need him on the floor as much as possible to have any shot. They need to have two bigs as much as possible. And then you have Kenny Atkinson playing Thomas Bryant in the fourth quarter. What the hell is Thomas Bryant doing out there in the fourth quarter of a playoff game? Be serious. And I think like the Sam Merrill, we talked about the OG Anunoby injury earlier, how critical that is for the Knicks. Sam Merrill hurt his hamstring for the Cavs in this game, and he's not a big name necessarily, but he is a good hard-nosed, solid defender, a really good three-point shooter. I would hope this means for Cleveland, it means more Jalen Tyson, who didn't hit a shot in this game. He's 0 for 1 in 18 minutes, but I think he provides a toughness on the defensive end of the floor. He had 5 boards in that game. He gets to the rim a bit. He's a good connective passer. Maybe for the Cavaliers, as much as I like Merrill as a role player, I hope this leads to Kenny Atkinson playing more Tyson, and that's another big body to put against Cade Cunningham as well. I'm not out on the Cavs. I'm not out. I think they still have a shot to win this game too, tie it up 1-1 before heading home. But I mean, look, it's just their stars just have to be better, Tom. It starts and ends there. Because we can talk all we want about Tyson and Bryan and those guys, and talk about, you know, Cade Cunningham could have better games. He probably will. And that even says more why your stars need to be better if you're Cleveland. But do you see any hope of that, though, with Allen and Mobley, considering everything you said earlier about this is the same thing as last year with them being a soft team? Like, what is the argument for this Cavs team to actually figure it out?
The argument is that James Harden and Donovan Mitchell are just going to outscore the opponent, because we know Evan Mobley is not the two-way force that he needs to be a 16-game winner, as Draymond Green likes to say it. You know, you need guys who are two-way stars in order to win championships, and Evan Mobley was supposed to be that guy. And he won Defensive Player of the Year in a sham award last year when Victor Wembanyama should have had it. Amen Thompson should have had it. But Evan Mobley, I just don't see how he's got the physicality to withstand. So it's going to come down to Donovan Mitchell and James Harden to raise that offensive rating, raise that ceiling. The scoring has to be, you know, enough to compensate for the lack of physicality underneath. And so it simply isn't there. When you talk about the offensive rating with Donovan Mitchell and James Harden in this series, it's not where it needs to be. They're not playing with that sort of offensive punch where it's unguardable. That's what you envision when you acquire him for Darius Garland at the trade deadline. He has a $40-plus million player option for next season that is partially guaranteed. And so, yes, it's only one game, but the way they looked, where they only scored 101 points in that game, and having Thomas Bryant minutes, double big lineups down the stretch with Dennis Schroeder, it just doesn't seem like Kenny Atkinson has the faith in his star players right now. And so it's worth wondering, already early in this series, when Tobias Harris is the second best scorer out there in this series, and I know he's had a great postseason, but when Tobias Harris is playing with more physicality and more force than your stars, that's a problem.
Absolutely. I mean, Tobias Harrison continues an excellent postseason. He's doing everything besides hitting threes in that game 7. He's getting to the mid-range, offering secondary creation, playing hard-nosed defense, rebounding the ball. I mean, Tobias Harris, I mean, it's so funny how hated he was in Philadelphia. And then he goes to Detroit, and he's becoming a playoff hero. So good for Harris, longtime pro, really good guy, and one of the reasons why the Pistons are even here in the second round right now, now up 1-0. Game 2 of that series is tonight, 7 p.m. on Prime. I'm looking forward to that one. And we'll be right back after this break. The other game tonight is Lakers-Thunder. We'll talk about that in a bit, but I want to start off with what happened last night in the Western Conference. The Spurs came back, destroyed the Wolves after losing game 1, 133-95. That series is now tied 1-1, Tom. On my podcast on Tuesday, I had Ryan Russillo on, and this was the morning after game 1. And Ryan and I talked about Mitch Johnson and the need for adjustments entering game 2. I'll tell you what, Mitch Johnson passes the test. The Spurs ramped up the pressure in this game, changed their defense entirely. They were playing with, you know, doubles and traps. You could see it right away when Anthony Edwards came in. They were helping off of Gobert, playing in the gaps, forced Naz Reid into a tough floater in this video you see on screen. Here, watch Mitch Johnson waving over, trap, 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 come on, come, trap, trap. And they trap Edwards right alongside the corner at the half court mark. Naz Reid gets the ball after it takes a pull-up three with 14 on the clock for whatever reason. And this happened until it was over, until all the starters got pulled. They kept the Wolves guessing, throwing some traps at Ant and Julius Randle. And with Randle, it just felt like every time they did it, it was turnover, turnover, turnover with just perfectly timed help from either Harrison Barnes or Stephon Castle. And it just led to a dominant first half by the Minnesota Timberwolves. Dominant first half by the San Antonio Spurs. It was absolutely unbelievable. Night and day compared to game one, Tom, with the pressure they put on this downhill attacking team, they weren't able to attack downhill.
It was a masterpiece. Like game two, well, masterpiece. You would never imagine a defensive team this young. Like 5 years ago, the idea is like you can't have your team be made up of 21-year-olds and win a championship because defensively they're just not going to be able to withstand the rigors of the postseason. Like that was the story in NBA history up until the Oklahoma City Thunder were able to prove this wrong last year. And they're using the same playbook, is just play with all of this mobility, use these double teams, this length, the speed. There was one play in the second quarter, I think it was Anthony Edwards was trying to go at Stephon Castle in the left corner, and he missed a three, like a little step back three in the left corner. And then Steph Castle just took off and ran for a fast break dunk that was like, it was a track meet. The offensive rating for the Minnesota Timberwolves was 60. 60 wow. points every 100 possessions. That was the scoring rate when Anthony Edwards, one of the best scorers in the NBA, one of the top postseason scorers we've seen the last few years, Western Conference last two seasons, and they couldn't do anything with him on the floor. They had 13 turnovers with Anthony Edwards on the floor to just 6 assists. A complete clinic, like you said. It was a masterpiece by Mitch Johnson. And look, this is what you want to see if you're the San Antonio Spurs. You want to see that their youth, their athleticism, their energy, it can overcome all of that playoff experience, because it looks like one team in that game was the team that has been to the Western Conference Finals the last 2 years, and it wasn't the team that actually did, because they were so much better, so much more fierce, and they played with that double team aspect that just completely flustered Anthony Edwards and Julius Randle in this game. They had no answers for it.
I thought it was fascinating in game one how the Wolves just kept attacking Wemby. Wemby ends up with 12 blocks in the game. One of them was a clear as day goaltend. Some of the others, you know, there's a block on Gobert that might have been a foul, but he had a lot of blocks and he had a lot of alterations as well. Like, regardless of the exact number, I'm not going to argue about it. Like, the Wolves rightfully did, right? I mean, they try to sway the officials. And then entering game two, I'm thinking, okay, let's see. Are they gonna test him again? And pretty early on in the game, I didn't feel like they were attacking as much. Terrence Shannon had a play where he started his drive and then he kind of went back out to the three-point line and took a pull-up. I'm like, huh, that's different. And then you look at the shot distribution numbers. Game one, with Wemby on the floor, the Wolves took 23% of their shots at the rim. That dropped to 8% in game two. Only 8% of their shots came at the rim with Wemby on the floor. And that's not just Wemby either. He was helping harder off some guys, off of Gobert at times, off of Jalen Clark when he was defending him. But I think it was just, it speaks to the collective changes the Spurs made on the defensive end of the floor, where they were helping harder off of guys. They were doubling more, packing the paint more often, and recovering outside. You know, on Anthony Edwards, they're blitzing out of the gaps. It's just really hard for Minnesota to get downhill. So it was Wemby, but it was this collective Spurs defense that showed why they were able to win, you know, be competitive, why Stephon Castle could be an all-defensive player on his own as well, why they're able to win a lot of games without Wemby this year as well. They played better with just Cornette out there. I thought in this game too, Cornette got shredded in game one. He survived in game two because of the collective defense. I thought, like you said, Tom, masterful is the word. Mitch Johnson answered a lot of questions. I know there was reporting that Greg Popovich was reporting film, watching film with the team and helping with the game planning and all that too. It's a, you know, family team effort for San Antonio, but I think that's that 8% of shots in the restricted area after they kept going in game one. Just such a dramatic difference.
I got to tell you, I also noticed watching that game how rare it was for Wemby to jump off his feet and try to contest at the rim. A lot of times he was just standing straight up, and whether he put his hands up or not. Minnesota looked a little spooked by just Wemby's presence in ways that we didn't see at all in game one. And I think it was a concerted effort by Wemby and the coaching staff to say, look, man, we need you for 48 minutes. Like, let's try to see how long you can go in game two. And in order to do that, we need you to conserve your energy a little bit more and not be flying around defensively around the paint when you don't need to. Like other guys, if you're 6'10", 6'11", you need to be jumping sky high in order to rim protect. But Wemby's just his very presence, I think, can scare guys from actually trying to go at him at the rim. And I think he learned that in game two, that he doesn't need to leave his feet. He's more susceptible to injury if he does that. He's more susceptible to losing his stamina if he's doing that. And I think they learned something in this game that even if he just stands there and doesn't leave his feet, he's going to be an imposing figure. And I do think that when you look at the Minnesota Timberwolves, the way they did not attack him, and oftentimes when they did, he was putting his arms around above his head, I think they realized that they weren't going to be able to get the same attack in game one as they did in game two. And I think the Spurs realized also, we can't have Wemby tiring himself out defensively. And be sure, there were times where he was just dominating the rim and leaping into the air to block those shots, but it was a lot fewer. And I think that was on purpose. I think with a deliberate intention to keep Wemby with not having tired legs and making sure he was healthy enough and just have enough energy so he wasn't exhausted in the second half.
I think that's an incredibly smart point, Tom. I mean, it makes me think about, there was a play where the Wolves actually scored, where you could see Naz Reid kind of attack the rim and he did a little pump fake. And Wemby's hands were straight up in the air. And then Naz Reid went up, you know, he tried to draw him. And then he went up anyway with a floater or, you know, kind of a hook shot high off the backboard. And it went in. It worked in that case. But at the same time, I think that speaks to exactly what you're talking about here with what we saw with the Spurs in that game. And a masterful game plan. I do think those little details, those little intricacies are exactly what happened between games one and game two. And the Spurs, we'll see how the Wolves respond in game three. I'm sure they're very fortunate to have a split in the series, but now they're going to be going back tied up 1-1. The Lakers and Thunder on that side of things, we are 1-0 in favor of Oklahoma City. And I'll tell you what, Tom, I don't like LA's chances one bit. There's been zero hints, good news, breadcrumbs about Luka coming back. The Thunder defense remains suffocating even without Jalen Williams. I can't find many reasons to feel any sense of optimism that the Lakers can even get a game in this series. I think we're going to see another Thunder sweep. I think the Thunder are going to be 8-0 heading into the Western Conference Finals. I think 16-0 is on the table for the Thunder, depending on how this Spurs-Wolf series goes. If it goes seven games, we'll see. They're going to be 8-0. I can't find an argument for the Lakers to win a game here.
Dude, I'm with you. I think it's a sweep, too. I mean, they had the worst Shea Gilgeous-Alexander possible, worst possible game, and they got blown out. You know, like, yeah. It's not going to happen again. And I think it's just they don't have the shooters to have that high variance. Being able to have LeBron surrounded by shooters is the only way that they're going to overcome the Thunder in this series. They did a pretty good job of getting the ball out of his hands, frustrating him. And ultimately, Chet Holmgren and the rest of the squad were way too strong when SGA did not have the ball in his hands. It was an awful game for him. And I also think that for Lakers, it's the Jake LaRavia minutes, and that's my guy, the Wake Forest University, Demon Deacon. But it's been really tough to watch him in this series, non-shooter. And Vando with the injury, the gruesome injury, he's probably out for the rest of the series, non-shooter. They just don't have the bodies. They don't. Now with Austin Reeves, he's missed 14 straight threes, dude. 14 straight threes. And in this series, you need Austin Reeves to have an MVP, All-NBA performance in order to survive. And they're getting the worst version of Austin Reeves. And so I think it's going to be a sweep. And it's unfortunate for LeBron because he is still playing at a high level, but no one else around him seems to be lifting up with LeBron. It just feels like this is another series where It's just OKC is so much better at the little things and have too many bodies. And on the other side, it just doesn't seem like Luka Doncic is coming back anytime soon.
Austin Reeves has been so bad in the postseason since he got back from injury. Do you contribute this to just coming back from an injury, or is this something where you're seeing the way he's playing and you're thinking Austin Reeves is losing himself some money this offseason?
Oof. So Austin Reeves came back from an oblique injury, which is no joke. And I think he wouldn't be playing if this was the regular season. I think he came back early because the Lakers are without Luka Doncic. If Luka is playing, I don't think Austin Reeves is playing. I think this is an injury that probably took a lot longer, but we've seen historically guys are willing to come back if they're 50-50, and we'll see if Austin Reeves is able to bounce back in game two. But the way that he operates, he needs to have that left-right mobility, the ability to finish at a high level. He hits the ground a lot. And when you have a core injury, it seems like Austin Reeves is not able to get those calls like he did in the regular season. And I don't know if he's sacrificing dollars. Like, I think he's shown enough over the years that he's worth the big contract that he has coming to him. I think this is just an oblique issue. I don't think this is an Austin Reeves issue. What do you think?
I think so. I think you're probably right. That said, if you're thinking about this guy, giving this guy a max contract, you sure would like to see some playoff performance on the biggest stage against the Oklahoma City Thunder. So hopefully for Austin Reeves' sake, he can have a big game by the end of his postseason run here. But I agree, it's likely due to injury, I'd say, for Austin Reeves. So that series is 1-0. Game two is tonight. Before we get to the draft lottery superlatives, some other news that happened this week. Giannis back in the news because Bucks owner Jimmy Haslam was asked about potential Giannis trades this offseason. And he basically said, it would make sense for us to do something before the draft, right? Like, that would make the most sense in the world. I thought the Jimmy Haslam quote was very fair. He said, get a lot of assets before the draft. And he also said, I just want to stress that our relationship with him, despite what is reported by certain ESPN writers, is very positive. We'll see. I mean, anytime you have a star player thinking about leaving, it can be positive, but you know, it's not as positive as it was when they're hoisting the Larry O'B. So all things are relative. And I think for the Bucks here, Tom, this makes sense to do something before the draft, given the fact that the Bucks do have a lottery pick. It cannot be number one because the Hawks have the rights to the swap, but there is still a slim 3% chance it lands in the top four. So for the Bucks here, I do think having clarity ahead of the draft, new head coach, Taylor Jenkins, everything I thought Haslam said was very fair. And one other thing he also said to Jenkins, there's no guarantee he's going to even be here, so don't take the job if you want to coach Giannis. It seems to me we're pointing towards a Giannis trade, but we'll see.
There's a lot of cognitive dissonance here because if Haslam, if you take his word for it, that the relationship is very strong and very positive, despite what you read from ESPN, you have a guy in his prime averaging 28, 10, and 5, and you're thinking about not giving him a contract and potentially trading him? No, the relationship can't be fine if you're thinking about moving off of Giannis and Antetokounmpo. It can't be fine. So the notion that everything's good in the Giannis relationship and Giannis the Milwaukee world, to me is insulting. Like, to think that this is everything's fine, nothing to see here. We might trade this guy, we might not. No, you don't trade a guy in the middle of his prime. He's won a championship. He's a multi MVP, a multi Finals MVP, and you're saying multiple MVP and a Finals MVP, and you're thinking about maybe it's time to trade this guy? I don't think so. I think he's trying to cover up and trying to, you know, put some fires out with this comment by saying everything's good. But I just, if everything was good, you're not thinking about trading him. I think he's gone. I think the comments here, you would have expected an ownership group to say he is going to be a Milwaukee Buck for life. Fact of the matter is, he is the best player to come through our organization since Kareem, and he is going to be a Milwaukee Buck for life. I'm sorry. no one's going to be able to get this guy. Instead, he's hemming and hawing and saying, yeah, we'll try to see what we can do, make a decision before the draft. So I think Giannis Antetokounmpo has played his last game with the Milwaukee Bucks, and those comments yesterday only confirmed that this is only a matter of time before they make a deal.
Well, earlier in the week, I said, I think it was my Monday show, I came up with a fake trade for the Celtics to trade Jaylen Brown to the Bucks, or I said the Hawks rather, in a three-way deal, and the Bucks would send Giannis to the Celtics, and the Hawks and Celtics would both send the assets to the Bucks. I do think it's worth thinking about, Tom, from the Bucks standpoint, that we talked about this on my pod earlier in the week from the Celtics standpoint, but from the Bucks standpoint, with the potential new lottery rules coming later this month, if it's voted and approved on, bottoming out doesn't matter as much. The Bucks don't have their own picks anyway. Do you think for Milwaukee it makes sense to add a star player like a Jaylen Brown type, bring someone in who can help you win games right away? Or because of the flattened odds, suddenly it doesn't matter if we're bad, it doesn't matter if we're at the bottom, we'll just take in other people's picks and build young? Because it just, when I think about it through the context of the Bucks, I feel like there's almost more optionality for them now entering this offseason when it comes to deals they might want to take. Because it doesn't matter if they're at the bottom anymore when they don't have their own picks. What do you think? What are your thoughts about how the Bucks should approach this offseason with Giannis trades?
It's a great point, because when you talk about the new draft reform proposal, a lot of people are saying, oh, it's going to kill all trades. Already we have free agency being dead. Now you're going to kill all of the trade potential, because now no one's going to want to give up their first round picks. But I think also it opens up more suitors. If you're able to get a good pick from not having to bottom out, I think it opens up more suitors in trades. And you're right to point out that the Milwaukee Bucks are probably going to be like, yeah, you know what? We don't need to only have five different teams and have their have conversations with a small subset of the NBA, because there are multiple ways for us to get good again. And it doesn't have to be that we have to break everything down to the studs. So number one priority for me, if I'm the Milwaukee Bucks, is go get control of your future picks so that you can enjoy the upside of having control over your picks. But I don't think the Portland Trailblazers, up to this point at least, have shown any inclination that they're willing to give those picks back to the Milwaukee Bucks. So I agree with you that the new reform lottery should help. The new lottery reform should help teams like the Bucks, but they just have to get some of their picks back.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look at it both ways. I mean, you can look at it like, yeah, it'd be nice to have control of your own picks. But at the same time, if the draft is random, what does it matter whose picks you have? Does that make sense? I mean, as long as they're in the lottery, you know, like you're gambling and you hope to get lucky on draft night. And maybe that's part of it here. And by the way, like in terms of three-way deals, I talk about Atlanta as a destination for Brown. If it's something involving Boston, if it's involving any team in the league, New Orleans has a Bucks pick in 2027 unprotected. So they do have one of the rights to the picks as well. So if perhaps New Orleans could be involved some type of three-way deal. And to pivot to Boston here, been an interesting week for Jaylen Brown and the Boston Celtics. Of course, he said on his Twitch stream on Sunday, less than 24 hours after their loss on Saturday in Game 7 to the Sixers, blowing a 3-1 lead, that this was his favorite season of his entire career. And that got, you know, a lot of news happening in Boston this week, a lot of talk about if Jaylen Brown is happy. But what really got conversation going was Tracy McGrady on his Cousins podcast. T-Mac and Jaylen Brown have known each other for a decade. McGrady has been a mentor to Jaylen Brown. Jaylen Brown was on the Cousins podcast earlier this year and said how T-Mac convinced him not to ask for a trade back in 2019. And McGrady said that, quote, his frustration lies deeply within the organization. And he went on to say how Jaylen Brown might be thinking something along the lines of, quote, I showed you guys more of who I am as a basketball player, not just what I did on the basketball court, but the leadership that I displayed with this team. And you've seen that. And so T-Mac saying this feels pretty big. Brad Stevens even acknowledged it on his press conference on Wednesday morning. He said, I talked to Jalen. It was nothing but positive. He has not expressed those frustrations to me. Jaylen Brown was on Twitch again on Wednesday night, and he said multiple times, I had to stream up myself. I didn't just watch the clips. I had the audio on. He said like five times at the beginning of the stream and then throughout the middle of it a few times, I love Boston. If it was up to me, I could play in Boston for the next 10 years. He said that same exact sentence like five times. If it was up to me, I could play in Boston for the next 10 years. So Jaylen trying to downplay things a little bit here, saying he loves Boston and all that. But Tom, the word choice is quite fascinating to me. If it was up to me, when he has a big contract extension coming up this offseason, he is eligible for a two-year, $135, $140-ish million extension. If it was up to me, I would sign that deal for to be here for the next 10 years. I think he is taking the right approach, Jaylen Brown is. I think he isn't. I think he is being genuine that he does love Boston. But at the same time, that doesn't mean he doesn't want his money. And it doesn't mean that the Boston Celtics with new ownership might be reluctant to want to pay him or might see things a different way about how they, you know, move this thing forward here. What are your thoughts on overall this week with the Celtics? Because you and I haven't talked about it at all. And a lot of it was added last night with JB out there on his Twitch stream once again.
Yeah, it seems like we're having like a mini Giannis situation here where no one wants to be the bad guy in this situation. And the irony is that you're proposing a three-way trade where Giannis ends up in a deal with Jaylen Brown. You know, Giannis ends up in Boston and Jaylen Brown leaves. And I think you are so right to point out the word choice here, that he has the caveat, that little phrase, the clause, if it was up to me, suggests that he is not getting the confidence that he wants to hear from the organization that he is going to get his max extension this offseason. And if Tracy McGrady was his mentor before and is saying that he has a deep, you know, troubles with the organization, if he is truly his mentor, he's saying that for a reason, that he wants people to know that the Boston Celtics are not on the same page with Jaylen Brown. And the obvious thing here is A, the contract extension, and B, perhaps some sort of power struggle with Jason Tatum. We haven't talked much about the Jason Tatum injury and the fact that he's coming back from an Achilles tear, came back and had all of this attention, and rightfully so, for his play coming back in that short time, you know, considering KD took so much longer to come back from his injury. And then you have Jaylen Brown here with the platform on his stream trying to yank the attention back to himself. And I think Tracy McGrady, by leaking that, or not leaking it because he said it on the record like very much publicly, but also I pointed this out on Wednesday's show on The Big Number. It didn't really make many waves, but David Thorpe over at True Hoop on April 20th, after the game one blowout against the Sixers. So he had no reason to report this because, you know, as we like to say, if it bleeds, it leads. As soon as a team starts struggling, you start to hear about unrest and players upset with each other. After game one, in which the Celtics won by like 30 points, David Thorpe wrote for TrueHoop.com. He said, hey, I've been talking to agents and players and coaches and execs around the league. And if I've learned anything, it's that Jamal Mosley is going to be fired after this series. And two, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are done. And that made my third eye open at that point. I was like, huh, that's not coming after a blowout loss when we typically hear this. This was even, as David Thorpe wrote, with the potential of Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown going on a big run in the postseason. He was willing to put that in writing. And so what Tracy McGrady said and what the reports are, it suggests that there is something deep within this relationship that seems fractured. And it would make a lot of sense that the Boston Celtics have not made overtures to say, hey, yeah, you're going to be a Celtic for life. We're going to give you every dollar that you want.
That I watched that whole Brad Stevens presser just because I was curious if there was anything else said in there that, you know, was pretty noteworthy. They blew a 3-1 lead, right? I expected Brad Stevens to just downplay. But he said a few interesting things. He said, you know, Joe Mazzulla said multiple times this postseason, you know, we got good quality shots. We just missed them. Brad Stevens said, I don't think we got quality shots. And he was asked by a reporter, do you guys shoot too many threes? And Stevens had an interesting line that just stood out to me. He said, we all would love dunks. I would love dunks. Do you know who dunks a lot, Tom? Who dunks a lot?
Giannis.
Yeah, exactly. So imagine Giannis and the Missoula system surrounded by space. That's my mind just went straight there. I would love dunks.
Yeah. The number one dunk leader in the NBA over like the last, you know, decade is Giannis Antetokounmpo. And I think also a couple other things I noticed. One, a very candid response about how maybe they were beating up on bad teams this year, that the record he was saying that basically our record was a little inflated because a lot of teams were tanking this year. And next year it's going to be a lot harder to win games in the league because tanking is going to be eliminated. So Kev, like, I think that's also something that Brad Stevens was kind of showing his cards in a way that he's usually a lot more guarded with his comments, but he thought that this team was a little overrated and the record was a little overrating this team. And so, yeah, I mean, just reading the tea leaves there, as you're seeing the quote here from Brad Stevens, there were a lot of teams in the NBA this year that were planning for draft positioning, tanking. That will not be the case next year. The regular season will be a lot better, and it will be probably give you a better indication of what everybody it really is. So on one hand, you can say, hey, Jaylen Brown deserves to be an MVP candidate because the Celtics won 56 games in the Eastern Conference with Jason Tatum largely out for the season. And Brad Stevens is out here saying, did you see how many teams were tanking this year? I don't think this was a really good, true evaluation of how good our team was. And so I thought that was interesting. And the direct comment about Jaylen Brown I found to be insightful in ways that maybe, you know, the actual words were not telling, but what he didn't say was telling, where he said, he has not expressed those frustrations to me. And the door is always open. 1 through 16, the door is always open. Mm. And to me, Kev, what that said was, hey, stop yapping on streams and stop yapping over at Tracy McGrady and leaking this to reporters. If you have a problem with the Celtics, come to me. Express it to me. Otherwise, I'm going to proceed that business as usual, Jaylen Brown, and you're happy and you're fine. That's how I read it, because when you're reading in between the lines of what Brad Stevens is saying, is he's downplaying that Jaylen Brown is unhappy because he has not heard it. Not that he's downplaying that he's unhappy. He has not heard it from Jaylen Brown himself. And it was almost like a dare. It was like, hey, if you really aren't happy, the door is open, Jaylen.
And I'll tell you what, I mean, he very well might hear it. That's where this could be going. Jaylen might want his own team. He might want to go home to Atlanta. I will see. We're going to find out in the weeks and months ahead, because there's a real chance that we are at the end of the road with Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. And it might be the right decision for Boston, Tom, because that big contract coming up for Jaylen, some of his flaws as a player, as great as he is, there's still just some holes with him as a playmaker and the flow in which he plays with on the offensive end of the floor. I think we're at the ceiling here. We are at true peak value for Jaylen Brown. And if this is the time to sell high, I would say we're at it for the Boston Celtics. We'll be right back. The NBA Draft Lottery is on Sunday. I'm fired up. I'm excited. We're going to look at some NBA Draft Lottery superlatives, Tom. And I want to start us off. We're going to have five of them. Let's start off with the Sam Hinkie Memorial Award, which we give to the season's most committed disciple of the process, the most committed tanker. You want to go first, Tom? Who wins the Sam Hinkie Memorial Award? And hopefully this team wins the draft lottery.
Okay, it's got to be the Washington Wizards' most committed tankers. And here's why. They traded good players for injured players, okay, at the deadline. They had Chris Middleton. They had CJ McCollum, and they were just balling out too well. And so they said, you know what? We're going to trade you for two guys who might not play the rest of the season, and that is actually an asset for a tanking team. Rarely do we see teams willingly trading for injured stars, but the Wizards We're inventing new ways to tank. They also benched their best players in crunch time in ways that they'd skirted any sort of punishment from the NBA. The NBA fined the Pacers and they fined the Utah Jazz, but the Wizards were doing the same exact thing. Alex Sarr or Bilal Coulibaly or whomever it was, Trey Johnson, Bob Carrington. Yeah, they're not all NBA talents, but down the stretch they were treated like ones if you are tanking. They played two-way guys, Leaky Black and Julian Reese, as if they were the best players on the team. If you look at their minutes per game there down the stretch of the season, it wasn't their best players that were getting the most minutes. It was their two-way guys. Leaky Black, for much of the season, was averaging over 30 minutes per game for the Wizards. And so congratulations. I am giving the Hinkie Award here, my personal, the Haberstroh Hinkie Award, is going to the Washington Wizards.
That's a good choice. I think it's the best choice. I would say honorable mention to the Indiana Pacers, because Rick Carlisle, from the start of the year, he's like, we don't have Tyrese Halliburton. I'm not calling timeouts at key moments. I'm putting lineups out there with no ball handlers. We are committed to getting the best odds possible. They have a 52.1% chance of getting a top four pick, also keeping their pick because it goes to the Clippers if they don't land in the top four after the Zubac trade. So I think the Pacers did a hell of a job. The Nets were just straight up bad. It wasn't even like Hinkie style to that extreme tanking. The Wizards are the right choice. I'd say honorable mention there to the Indiana Pacers. Grizzlies did a good job mid-year too. I mean, they had Ryan Rupert in early April, who had a 30-point triple-double, and they sent him to the G League the next day. I mean, good on you. They didn't get all the way to the bottom, so it's not quite worth the Hinkie Memorial Award, but those are some good choices there. Next up, the frozen envelope. If the NBA fixed it, who would they want to fix it for?
Ooh. All right, so the Knicks winning it with Patrick Ewing in the first year of the draft lottery that was televised as a marquee event by David Stern. A brilliant stroke of genius to put the draft lottery on national television and give it to the team, the biggest market, the New York Knicks, for the Georgetown stud, Patrick Ewing. Obvious case here for me is the number one most valuable franchise in the NBA, the Golden State Warriors, getting the number one overall pick. Because you've got the Chase Center, you've got Steph, you've got Joe Lacob, and you know the ratings are sky high every time the Golden State Warriors are on national TV. And you got Amazon Prime, NBC, and ESPN all clamoring to juice their ratings and their stats and draw the biggest audiences possible. And what better way to do that than to give the richest, most valuable franchise in the NBA the number one overall pick in a Cam Boozer, AJ DeBonta draft. If you also want to look at like the whole Steve Kerr, is he coming back? Is he not coming back? It's May 7th. And maybe there's a little bit of Steve Kerr waiting to see what happens on Lotto night to see whether he wants to come back for maximum opportunity here. Because again, this isn't maybe the Warriors say if they win the draft lottery, maybe they trade it for a superstar and get an opportunity to load up with Steph Curry and Steve Kerr for one last hurrah. Or he might say, we didn't win the lottery. We didn't get that opportunity, and you know what? It's time for me to go. So I think all of this points to the Golden State Warriors, for me, being if the NBA was fixing it, it would be the Golden State Warriors. What say you?
I think the Warriors are the most obvious choice for exactly all the reasons you stated, Tom. And I do think you're spot on about Steve Kerr. If I'm Steve Kerr, I'd wait until Sunday as well. I would wait to see what happens with the draft lottery. However, how about the Chicago Bulls as our frozen envelope team here? Because let's bring the Bulls back. Let's bring them back. They've got some solid young players. They have a new GM. They're gonna have a new coach. They're just missing their megastar. If you give the Bulls AJ DeBonta with the number one pick, or even like we have the top four odds on screen, any of the top three or four picks, a 20.3% chance for the Chicago Bulls. I like that team if they get one of these top players. So I'd say the Warriors for sure, considering everything you said, market size, Stephen Curry, all that, yada, yada. But the Bulls too. If I'm fixing it for anybody and I want it to be a little less obvious, I'd fix it for the Bulls. Gave them DeBonsa.
Yeah, they had the number one pick in 99 with Elton Brand, of course. Derrick Rose also winning the lottery. And that year, the Chicago kid comes home in 2008. You know, they haven't had the best lottery odds, you know, in the last few years, which was the problem, was that they were not committed to the tank. So if it happened this year, it would be funny that the one year that they do commit themselves to the tank and they get rid of Ayo Dosunmu and Kobe White and hand them to playoff aspiring teams, it would make sense that they would win it this year. So if the lottery is rigged, you would say the Warriors or the Bulls. I would also throw in the Clippers winning the lottery and thereby the Oklahoma City Thunder winning the lottery. But the whole market size thing never really added up to me, and all the accusations that the NBA would want to rig this for OKC. I don't think what's the David Stern line? The best NBA finals isn't Lakers-Knicks. It's Lakers-Lakers. He wants the big market. Wanted, I should say, RIP, may God rest his soul. David Stern wanted the big markets to be successful, but not in a way that he would fix it. But I would say OKC, I think a lot of people would expect it to be rigged if they got it too.
Adrian in the chat said the obvious answer is Chicago, get it to an Eastern Conference team. That's a good point. Kind of balance out the conferences a little bit more. What if we get four teams in the top four, all from the Eastern Conference? That would feel like a frozen envelope for sure. Next category here, the misery index. These are the fans that have suffered the most and for the longest. Who's your choice here, Tom?
Okay. This is a tough one. I thought about Sacramento. I thought about the Wizards. But I'm going to go with Utah Jazz. And for this reason, the Utah Jazz are a small market team that they don't have the same avenues that other teams have in order to roster build. They also have never moved up in the lottery. Ryan Smith, the owner of the Utah Jazz, went on Pat McAfee and talked about how not only have they not won the lottery ever, but they've never, ever moved up in the lottery. Think about that. So you're talking about a Jazz fan base that came this close to winning the championship multiple times against Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls. And then without Karl Malone and John Stockton, with that sunsetting that duo there, they had the Deron Williams, they drafted him in the Chris Paul draft, but they have yet, in 11 times being in the lottery, they have never moved up once. And last year in the Cooper Flagg draft, they moved all the way down to get Ace Bailey. I feel like a team with the second worst record over the last 4 years, outside of the Washington Wizards, the worst team over the last 4 years, they've been in the top five three times, never gotten number one, and in the 11 lotteries, they've never moved up. To me, that's the longest suffering franchise, the Utah Jazz.
I'm going to say the Kings. And I'm going to say the Kings because they got a tease. They got a little taste of success after decades of failure and disappointments and Bagley over Luka and just mistake after mistake after mistake, trading Halliburton. It's endless for Sacramento. And they got a taste. Light the beam. This is an amazing year. And what has it been since then? Worse and worse every year. That's what it's been. And now they're a 22-win team with a crap roster with an okay future. If I'm a Kings fan, I'm like, oh, I thought we were out of it. We're right back in the bottom of the barrel. That's not worse than always being bad. At least they got a taste. But in some ways, it kind of is, Tom. Once you have a taste of that success and then immediately it's taken from you. Oh my God, I can't imagine what it's like to be a Kings fan. So I'm going to say the Kings lead the misery index category. That said, though, Tom, for our next category, the Eli Manning special. If this team wins, their number one prospect asks to go somewhere else. I think the Kings are the answer for this one as well. If the Kings go to number one, I'm not sure AJ DeBonsa isn't going to try to say, I want to go number three instead to, I don't know, whoever the team is, the Mavericks. I want to play with Cooper or the Hawks. If they move up, I want to be the final piece there. I think there's a scenario in which we really could see that this year. We haven't seen, like, we saw Sarr angle his way to the Wizards a few years ago. He didn't want to go to Atlanta. He didn't work out for them, didn't provide records, showed zero interest in going there, and they didn't take him. He went to the Wizards. That's where he wanted to go. So there's a little bit of that, but wasn't to the ugly extreme of Eli and his father being involved and not going to the Chargers. He wanted to be with the Giants. I wouldn't rule that out this year. I wouldn't rule it out depending on how the board falls.
I will go as far as to say, I think that AJ DeBonta, if the Kings win the lottery, I think he will pull an Eli Manning. I think not ruling it out is not going far enough. And here's why I think this. This is a guy who went to BYU, got the money and all the power and all that at BYU, made the choice himself. And all of these athletes in the NIL era are used to having that agency. They are used to making the decision for themselves. In years past in the NBA, this was not the case. It was not the case that these players were getting paid and had the chance to make the decisions for themselves and dictate where they were going to go. And now in this era, I feel like we are headed towards a situation where you cannot be an incompetent organization and just luck your way into the number one overall pick and not having that variable looming overhead. And I think if it's AJ DeBonta or Cam Boozer, whose father, Carlos Boozer, played long time in the NBA, I think the dynamics are shifting. And I would not be surprised at all if whoever wins, whoever the Sacramento Kings, if they win the lottery, is going to have a hard time convincing that player to stay with that organization. So I'm with you. I think it's the Kings. I think they are standing by Doug Christie. If you're AJ DeBonta and saying, hey, do I want to sign with this team? Remember that this team got investigated for tanking, but was exonerated because they were incompetent. Their coaching staff, led by Doug Christie, was so incompetent and bad at their job that they were investigated for tanking by the league office. And it was, obviously a non-story after that. They weren't tanking. He just screwed up big time. So the Sacramento Kings have made the playoffs once in the last 20 years. The fans have suffered. And I think without a total shift in the organizational structure and ownership, I think there is a real problem looming overhead if they win the number one overall pick. I think there is going to be a lot of nerves in the Cowbell Kingdom if the Sacramento Kings win the number one overall pick and you hear any sort of whispers that AJ DeBonta or Darren Peterson or Cam Boozer, if they're just like, we'd rather go to the Golden State Warriors at number two. Or we'd rather go to the Oklahoma City Thunder at number five. And seeing how this all plays out, I think the Sacramento Kings are in a world of trouble, even if they get the number one overall pick.
It's just there's so many moving pieces in the league right now. Like, let's just say the Hawks end up with the fourth pick or the third pick, and they decide, we'd rather trade that for Jaylen Brown, or the Celtics are in the third or fourth slot. DeBonta is a Celtics fan. From Brockton, Massachusetts. Brockton represent AJ DeBonta, him and I growing up in the same city. I think he'd force his way to Boston. I think if the Warriors move up, why wouldn't you want to play with Steph for the latter seasons of his career? There's just a lot of interesting teams that I think you might rather go third than first, depending on how the board falls. And we'll see. We'll see how things go. When I had Ryan Russillo on the podcast earlier in the week, I said, how are you going to react if OKC wins the lottery? And he said he's rooting for it for a lot of different reasons. And, just to kind of, he wants to get mad at the media. He wants media to get, to say, we need to change the rules and all that, this and that. And I said, I just want to see people go crazy, which is why for the last category here, the doomsday pick, it's clearly the Thunder, right? They're the winner that needs the help the least and causes the most chaos league-wide. They have a 7.1% chance of moving into the top four with those Clippers odds that they have from that SGA Paul George deal a few years back. This is also a doomsday pick, though, Tom. Ryan brought up from an agent's perspective, because if you're the agent of DeBonta or Peterson or Boozer or Wilson, and you get drafted by Oklahoma City with a top four pick, enjoy playing 17 minutes a night next year, coming off the bench. Maybe not even playing every game. Enjoy.
Stop. Stop. You're saying Cam Boozer would be coming off the bench if he was drafted by the AJ Dabatsa?
Well, I mean, who's he going to play over? Is he going to play start over Chet or Hartenstein? No, he's going to play ahead of Jalen Williams. That's it.
No, I don't see that. I think it's Chet at the five, Cam at the four, and Jalen at the three. That's how it would go down. So, but you're right. You're right. If OKC wins the number one overall,
I'm saying Jalen Williams, J Will, not J Dub, Jalen Williams, the backup center. Like he's gonna Cam Boozer's gonna play ahead of him, but he's I don't think he's starting over Hartenstein or Chet.
I don't know. I think Cam is too. You know, I'm a huge Cam believer, and so he's awesome. The point is here that not only do the Oklahoma City Thunder have the rights to the Clippers pick here, where they also have the swap next year. And so there is potential for the Clippers to get gift wrap this pick to the Thunder, not just this year, but next year when the draft lotto odds potentially flatten. There is another opportunity here for the Thunder to go back to back in ways that it would be a weird loophole, right? If you can go back to back with someone else's pick, the league wouldn't bar that, right, Kev?
From what we understand so far, the answer to that is they wouldn't prevent it. However, it's May 7th. We have 3 weeks until the owners meet on May 28th. There's another GM meeting next week during the NBA draft combine, an in-person meeting. I think we're going to get a revised understanding of what the proposal will be sometime next week. And so whatever we heard about late last month with the 3-2-1 proposal, I think next week we're going to hear the newest edition of that. And so there'll be more clarity to answer a lot of these different questions.
Yeah, and that's a good point, is that we're probably going to find out here in the coming days about the little provisions, the little exceptions to the rule. Yes. And I think Ryan is 100% right on this, is that it would cause people to lose their minds if this were to happen. You're right. Like this is what I keep saying, is that if the NBA is going to flatten the odds and invite playoff teams to the mix, they've got to be prepared for the calls that this is rigged. We're talking about it right here, is frozen envelope award. Like this would only grow louder if they flatten the odds that this is rigged. And of course, all of the NBA's the most conspiracy theories are always surrounding the draft lottery. And so the best way to get rid of that conversation is to get rid of the draft lottery altogether and just go to the rookie free agency, which is my weekly call here on this show, Kev, to say that we need to get rid of the draft altogether. But maybe
2029. 2029. Maybe that's when we'll see it.
That's right.
I was going to say, there's no other answer, right? Besides OKC, there's no other doomsday. I don't think so, right?
This is a year in which I don't think there's a lot of, you know, weird swaps in the lottery. Atlanta, if they get it, I don't think people are like, this is going to ruin the Eastern Conference going forward. No. I would say most people are like, yeah, I mean, that makes the Hawks better, but this isn't like, they're not a juggernaut right now. It's certainly they could win the East in the next few years with the number one overall pick, but I wouldn't say that it would be doomsday. I don't know. I mean, I'll ask you, if you know the Milwaukee Bucks can't get the number one overall pick, but if they get two or three, does that change things for Giannis in that situation, or do you suspect that they will go further into a rebuild or moving on even quicker from Giannis if they land AJ Dabatsa, Darren Peterson, or Cam Boozer?
I mean, just to make it clear to the listeners, the Bucks have a 3% chance of ending up with a second, third, or fourth pick, roughly. The probability, because you need to consider that the Hawks, that with the Pelicans pick or one of those two picks would have to end up number one or two or three, and then another pick would have to be in the fourth slot. It's just a low probability that both of those picks end up in the top four. But if it happens, and there's a chance it happens, a 3% chance roughly that it happens, I don't think it changes things with Giannis unless there's another star player out there that it makes sense to give that up for. And who is that star player that could be available on the horizon? Is it like Jaylen Brown? Like, would Giannis want to stay if they add Jaylen Brown? I'm not sure there. I don't think that's a perfect fit. I don't know if it's enough for me if I'm Giannis to want to stay. I don't think you're giving that pick up for Kawhi Leonard. I don't think you're giving I don't think Donovan Mitchell would want to go there if the Cavs implode. I don't know if the Bucks would even want to give that pick up for Mitchell. I don't think it would make sense to do that. I can't think of a name that makes sense.
Can I ask you this? Because I wrote when the Nuggets were eliminated, I wrote this column about Jamal Murray trades, and I just don't know how they pivot and make any meaningful change in Denver without trading Jamal Murray. And there's just so many negative contracts on that roster. I got from Toronto Raptors fans saying the only guy that they would trade Colin Murray Boyles is Jokic. That even if Jamal Murray was coming, they would not move CMB in a deal for Jamal Murray. And I thought to myself, well, who would you trade CMB for in a deal? And it seemed like Raptors fans were like, we don't want to have anything to do with it. Even if it's Jamal Murray who's coming back home to Canada, if it means giving up CMB, they don't want to do it. And I was like, all right, well, if that's not the case, where would Denver go next? And in the Jaylen Brown conversations are there too, is what are the stars? What move does Denver make? What move would Milwaukee make if they're going to move the number two overall pick, let's just say, for just hypothetically? I said Kevin Durant might be an option for the Denver Nuggets if they move off of Jamal Murray and you get younger if you're Houston and you get a more reliable long-term, more reliable option in Jamal Murray. It is more in the timetable of your youthful core. KD is going to be less expensive on the books and not as much long-term money. So by getting KD, yes, he's 37, going to be 38. But you can get some more flexibility financially if you're Denver by swapping those two. And I also thought that if the Detroit Pistons were going to be eliminated in the first round, do they try to get more scoring and shooting and playmaking with Jamal Murray and make a swap for Ausar Thompson? And I don't know if they make that trade now, but only in the instance of if they were going to lose in the first round in embarrassing fashion, do they make a trade like that. But if you're Denver, we haven't talked about it since they were eliminated. If you're Denver, I think this is the same conversation for the Milwaukee Bucks and the same conversation for the Boston Celtics, is who is the guy that you're willing to give up Jamal Murray for or Jaylen Brown for, or for Giannis's sake, like what is the guy that you're willing to trade to get a partner for Nikola Jokic? And it's just going to be a tough conversation for Nuggets fans. What do you do here?
It's an incredibly tough question. Like, they just don't have picks. They have their 2026 pick this year, and then they just have swaps moving forward. The Thunder have their picks in 27 and 29, top five protected, as hard as that is to believe. They just don't have the assets. Peyton Watson, an upcoming free agent. They don't have picks. They don't have young players. Jamal Murray is the most tradable high-value asset after the regular season that he had as a first-time All-Star. I think even Aaron Gordon's value is a bit declined after playing 86 games total the last 2 years, injuries and two postseasons in a row. Nuggets are in a tough spot. Jokic says he wants to be there. Giannis and the Bucks are in a tough spot. Giannis, we'll see. It seems like he doesn't want to be there, and Brad Stevens is waiting to hear from Jaylen Brown, as you said earlier, Tom. He hasn't said it to me. We'll see in the weeks ahead if he actually does that. I can't wait till Sunday, Tom. The NBA draft lottery, it's 30 minutes of just fun and just, it's a thrill. It's an absolute thrill every year. And this year, there's just so many crazy things that can happen, and the stakes are so high with this year's draft class with DiBonsa, Peterson, Boozer, Wilson, top four, and then so many good players behind them. This, like, what's going to happen Sunday is going to determine what the next decade plus of basketball could look like, and I just can't wait. We're going to be live on YouTube reacting to the draft lottery as it happens. We're going to do an instant mock draft on Sunday as well. I can't wait for that. I'm so excited, Tom. You got anything else going on this weekend besides watching the draft lottery, more playoff basketball, anything going on? Mother's Day. That's all Sunday. Yes, Mother's Day is Sunday.
Yeah, we got lots of playoff basketball. And it's going to be an interesting time for the Charlotte Hornets, too, here in Charlotte. They got lotto odds here as well. So I know people here in town will be watching on Sunday, even if the team isn't in the playoffs like they were hoping for. So lots happen. And your draft guide, I will be reading it a lot more now
Friday morning, Tom. Friday morning. coming out, the draft guy dropping 60 profiles. We're going to have multiple big boards, a mock draft. And then we get some other stuff coming later in the month or early this next month as well in early June that I'm very excited about. But this is the soft launch with 60 profiles ahead of the draft lottery. So yeah, be sure to check that out. We'll have a link on the podcast on Sunday, draft lottery day, once we post that. Tom, thanks for joining me today, man. Hope you have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy the games, enjoy the draft lottery. And everybody watching us live on YouTube, thank you for checking us live. Please be sure to subscribe. Give a like if you have not done that already. Have a good day, everybody. Thank you to Tom Havisham for joining me on today's episode. As I said to him, we get a busy podcast week ahead on Sunday. Going to be reacting live on YouTube to the draft lottery. Also going to have a podcast version of that posted afterwards with winners and losers, instant mock draft. That'll be a fun show on Sunday. Then Monday we'll be back, Tuesday as well. Then next Thursday, it's going to be a very, very loaded week for the podcast with so much going on in the NBA playoffs, NBA draft combine, NBA lottery. I'm excited about all of it. Thank you to Emmy and the whole team for producing today's episode. Hope you have a good rest of your day and enjoy the games.